Coming up Sunday morning at 9 on Hometown Heroes. He's having a big celebration in Bakersfield this weekend because it's his 92nd birthday. And he'll take us back 70 years to when he was using his mechanical talents in Europe during World War II.
We invented the rear landing wheel on a glider.
That story may not end the way you expect, but you'll enjoy this Bakersfield veteran's gracious spirit on Hometown Heroes, Sunday morning at 9 on 1560 AM and 97.7 FM KNZR.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are indeed heroes around you. There are men and women who have done remarkable things for the sake of our country, fighting for our freedom, and we don't want to forget that. So the purpose of this show is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot. We're educated. We're certainly entertained and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I hope that'll be the case today as you get a taste of the special spirit of a man who's gathering with family this weekend in Bakersfield, California to celebrate his 92nd birthday. Back on November 8th, 1922, he was born in the Ozarks. Jake Luttrell. Don't call him Luttrell, or you'll get it wrong. And when I walked up to the door, I saw a little sheep on a board. It said Luttrell Farms, but I don't smell the sheep around here. Where are you hiding them?
They're down in the basement. No, they were on the farm when my granddaughter, Lori, here was little, and her dad set her up with one or two sheep. But no one is on the farm anymore, so it's just a sign.
Well, we're not putting you out to pasture either, so don't be worried. But I imagine you might have seen a sheep or a cow or some kind of livestock out in the Ozarks growing up. Tell me about your childhood back in Missouri.
Well, down in the Ozarks where all eight of the children in the family started, it was strictly farming, such as up in the flatlands of Missouri, but also cows and horses and chickens and the whole nine yards. And then in 1928, we moved up more or less mid-state, about 70 miles south of Kansas City, along the Missouri-Kansas line, and was there for a good long while. In fact, that's where I lived when the wife and I got married and come to California.
Well, there's a story there, too, that I want to hear. But before we get to that, you said eight children. Where were you on that list of eight?
As the last one.
You're the youngest of eight.
I'm the only one left.
You must have got beaten up a lot by all those older siblings.
Verbally, even as well as physically.
Do you remember, I know that's a long time ago, but do you remember what kind of ambitions you had? What you thought you might be doing with yourself?
Maybe not as much as I would be now, because times were so tough. We had our mind on working and doing something to cause us to be able to eat. Really, it was that simple. And yet I would say, for the most of us, it was wanting to go to school and do something besides digging the ground. But we just didn't all make it out. Turned out to be a blacksmith, and the others went to school.
You said it was hard, those depression days. How hard was it? How bad was it? Can you give us an example of the things, the sacrifices that you and your family had to make?
I can tell you a little story, strangely, that I remember today. My brother was closest one to me, about 3 years difference. And one day we made an agreement. We were going to check and see how much money was actually spent at the country store by our family, and there was he and I and mom and dad yet at home, and we kept close watch. And the first month it was, I think, $4.10, and the next month we was trying harder, I guess it was just a little less than $4 cash. That is, we'd trade in hens and a pig maybe for flour and sugar and things like that. But it couldn't have been much worse in a sense, and yet survived in good shape. I mean, we never went hungry, but money was non-existent. Just didn't have any.
Looking back now, what do you think that did for you and your perspective on life in general?
Well, I think it was probably some of the best education that we ever got in our lives. Something that maybe some of the young people ought to get today. We never had any wishes for instance, a new car or anything like that, because it wasn't even in the book. And consequently, we fought it out until World War II made a big difference. After World War II was over, people kind of made a new start. There was jobs that wasn't there before. Every time we could take a step up forward, we did. Whereas today, I've made my thoughts of being a funny. I said, well, the young people today want to start at the top and work their way up.
There's a lot of truth in that statement. You didn't have a choice. And did you start to develop some of your mechanical skills back home as a young boy? Were you tinkering and fixing things that young?
Very little, because of the fact that there was no tools. We had an old hammer, an old handsaw, and a few rusty nails, and that was about the size of it. My dad was a country farmer, preacher. Did a good job at what he done, but he wasn't a mechanic. Now, immediately following with the war, almost all young people had an opportunity to get into something that would cause them to be able to develop into a decent job, and then, like I say, it would just gradually improve as time went on. And I went on, well, after I got out here.
I got to get that story how you came out here, though, because this is a pretty good story. What year was that?
1941.
But there's a little lead up to this here. So you've been seeing this girl for a while. You're what, 18 years old at the time, not quite 19?
About 18.
And you told your parents you're going to join the military. And what'd they say?
Well, of course, I married an older woman. She was a year older than me.
So first you said, I'm going into the service. And they said no, and then your comeback was, well, then I'm moving to California.
Well, it was the war, and stories you read indicated that there was changes, movement, and that was the other thought to come in my mind. If I couldn't get in the military, why, all of this was going on in California. That's where all the milk and honey was. Now, not that everything was all that much better at that time, but it developed quicker.
So you thought, let's go to California, and you mentioned that to your girlfriend, and she said what?
She said, well, I think we ought to get married first. Well, I don't know. I could say anything good about her wouldn't be questioned by these people here, my granddaughter and grandson. Not too many around. I can say they didn't make them like that anymore. She was, that's her right up there. She made life so much easier on a husband and wife team. We never had hers and mine, like bank accounts or anything like that. It was ours. Made it much, much easier.
But you had a real expensive and elaborate and costly wedding, right?
My father-in-law gave me a nickel, and who's to say if that was all just a joke or funny or what, but my mom and dad would have given me their left leg if I'd asked for it, but they didn't have a penny. And we didn't fuss about it, didn't have any problem whatsoever. We did go out and spend a night with them, believe it or not, before we took off for California, and just had a great time. And then on the way out in that 31 Model A, that was our fun trip as newlyweds. We had her mother and my mother and her little brother and the wife and I in that Model A Ford.
And were you exaggerating earlier when you told me that it was a $2 wedding? Was that really the price of the whole thing?
That was a fact. I gave the Justice of Peace a dollar, and then the certificate was a dollar. Well, then later I had given her a ring. It was used, and it was something like a dollar and a half. We didn't go broke by throwing money.
But lo and behold, it worked out all right, huh?
Yeah, it was strange. Some of the people that always would pick it, young people, said, well, we'll give them 30 days. Well, when Mom died, it was, what, 59 years? Would have been 73 years or so if she hadn't have passed away. It just goes to show you that sometimes the experts can be wrong.
So you come to California, and I think you started to say you ended up at the shipyards. Is that what you were doing before you ended up in the service?
Yeah. My first real job was down here at the old Padre Hotel, which is still in business. But when this job opening come up down south, at the Cal Shipbuilding on the west side of Long Beach. Well, just no way in the world you could turn it down.
What kind of ships were you guys building?
Liberty ships.
And is that where you were when you found out the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor?
That was where I was at when Franklin Roosevelt located me and sent me an invitation. Come see us.
Yeah, I've heard about those invitations. Well, what do you remember about December 7th? Because everybody that I've talked to seems to remember something about that day and how they found out.
I was working down in Los Angeles at a fruit farm that is the warehouse in town from the fruit farm. It come on the radio, of course, and spliced all over that the Japanese had struck Pearl Harbor. And we didn't have, of course, the facilities that you do today, but the foreman had an old 50-foot drop cord. And he rigged up and plugged it in, and he had a little radio just, oh, gee, you could put it in your pocket nearly. He plugged that in, and he let everybody quit, gathered around that table for, oh, 2 hours or longer. We listened to the comments, news, and so forth. But it was hard to understand the size of it. All of us were young. It was hard to understand why people would want to butcher and kill, but then later it become a little easier to understand when you've seen it.
Yeah, you would see plenty not against the Japanese, but against the enemy in Europe. And you mentioned getting that invitation from the president, Uncle Sam, saying, we want you. So you're working in the shipyard at the time. That's obviously related to the war effort. But they drafted you. What'd you think about that? How'd you feel about that?
Well, frankly, I was a little upset because the wife was carrying our first son. And I went to the draft board. It was an older man and two older women. And I said, I'm sorry, you can't have me right now. I said, told them situation. Oh, well, that doesn't make any difference. You're just exactly what we need. You've got the experience. And I said, no, I can't go off and leave them. I reached up and got a pen and a piece of paper, and I wrote down there Amsterdam, Missouri, or Butler. I went home and told Mom, and she got the fruit jar where she'd been collecting our money. And we had a 37 Ford coupe. I've got pictures of it. We got in that dude and headed for Missouri. Well, when I got there, they were already there. Waiting on me.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there listening right now who understand why you would have done anything to be there for your pregnant wife. But now you're drafted, you end up in the Army Air Corps. I know they had you train in Florida for a bit, but then you got to go to St. Louis for aircraft welding school. What kind of things did you learn over there?
Well, first of all, I learned a lot about dealing with each other, people on people. And then, of course, in this aircraft welding, was great.
How to repair an airplane that had been damaged and weld pieces back together kind of thing?
Well, and doing even any kind of, at that time, light welding, because in the aircraft welding was pretty much all light instead of like if you've been in a shipyard, why, it's heavy welding.
And I know you had some more training in Salt Lake City, but then your final training was something called Overseas Fitness, which concluded in a pretty unique way.
Our last training on that was going across country in a train of boxcars, cattle cars, with about 95 prisoners, and then my buddy and I. That was an experience.
These are German prisoners?
Ours. They were promised free and out of, and they were actually in jail. I mean, actually prisoners. If they would volunteer to go overseas because they felt like they needed more people than what they were getting by drafting. But it didn't work. They went haywire before we got to Chicago, and they had to call out the state militia and take over.
So you were on a train that the state militia had to take over?
Mm-hmm. Because they took us from Chicago then to Camp Kilmer, New Jersey, and that's where we stayed for about a week and then left to go overseas from there.
Was that a little scary there when you've got all these convicts and the militia has to take over? Were you worried about anything?
I don't know where they went because, as it turned out, the ones that actually went to Europe where we did was such a failure that, for the most part, people said they're not worth chasing down. It costs too much money, too much time. They've become part of the English population.
And I'm sure a lot of folks are like me, and they've never heard about that before. Convicts getting the chance at amnesty in exchange for going overseas to fight in World War II. And you mentioned going overseas. We should mention your son was about 3 weeks old when you shipped out. Did you get a chance to get home and see your wife and that firstborn child before you headed overseas?
Yes, they sent me home in an old C-47, cold as blazes. Of course, that thing didn't have like airplanes today. It wasn't insulated. It was just skin. And I was wrapped up in blankets and laying on the floor, and I got to Kansas City. I made it. It was worth it to get to come home and see the baby and see the my wife. But then never seen him again until the war was over.
So years going by here. How hard was that to leave for Europe? Because now, I mean, you can look in the rearview mirror and you know what happened, but you didn't know what was going to happen. To head overseas and leave behind a wife and an infant, how difficult was that?
It was difficult. Of course, everything was a change. You didn't really have the time to think about how bad it was like you would maybe at a different time, although it was tough. But there was just so much to do and deal with.
Well, and I want to talk about some of those things you were busy doing, but right now we need to take our first commercial break. If you want to see pictures of our birthday boy, Jake Luttrell, then and now, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Radio Facebook page. When we come back, we'll hear about an invention this welding aficionado's ingenuity produced in Europe during World War II. And why it's a bit of a bittersweet memory for him today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with U.S. Army Air Corps veteran Jake Luttrell of Bakersfield, California, where he's celebrating his 92nd birthday this weekend. He's lived in that area since World War II, and if you ever needed a custom welding job, a trailer hitch, you name it, he probably did it for you. If you've driven by Christ Church of the Valley on Stockdale Highway in Bakersfield and seen those three giant white metal crosses towering 40 feet in the air, those are a lasting example of Jake's work with metal. Welding is what he did a lot of during World War II, serving with the 878th Air Engineering Squadron in England and France, a few other places. What can you tell us, Jake, about the nature of the work you were doing?
Well, for the most part, repair and upkeep of our equipment that we had, whether you was stationed with OB-17s or 24s, or like we wound up in the 9th Air Force, and basically it was the old C-47s and gliders. It was constantly repairing and changing this and that. Me and a friend of mine, we invented the rear landing wheel and the bracket setup to mount it on a glider, and a friend of ours could do paperwork just like you would if invention on anything. And he did, and he took it up to the office, and the second lieutenant took it upon himself to send it back to Ohio, to the headquarters, and told him it was what he worked out, and he would like to see it used. Nothing flat. They was sending all the equipment and all the paperwork and everything over there, putting it on every single glider. He called me in there one day, and just as the only time we ever had a word in that respect. And he said, what are you going to say when they ask you if you had anything to do with this? Well, I said, I just tell them the truth. Why? Because I didn't know what he had in mind. I said, me and Wesley here, we spent a lot of time thinking about it and working with the an engineer there that was in the flight line and worked this out. Got a little help from one of the boys that done tool work. And he said, well, I'd just rather you keep your mouth shut and say nothing. Well, that kind of put me back because I didn't know what he meant. So I just turned around and walked out. Well, boy, the next thing I knew, he put out word that, well, he didn't say he wanted me shot, but I was no good and so on and so forth. Well, he sat there and got a big commendation from Ohio national level. And, oh, I don't know, just he was quite a hero.
So he took the credit for what you guys invented.
But that wasn't anything real unusual. People didn't realize that military was full of politics. Whatever you could gain with this kind of a thing. Because you always had the people that was in charge of all the different areas. They could make this thing work.
Up until that point, the gliders that you guys were working with, they didn't have any landing gear on the back?
They did, but every time they landed, it tore all to pieces.
What was so ingenious about what you and your friend put together that made it work?
First of all, we changed the wheel to a bigger bearing. And then it was, of course, the bracket we engineered to hold it against the frame. See, the frame of the units that we put it on was steel tubing throughout the whole thing. So you could tie in up, down, back and forth. We used to laugh about it and say, well, we're not buying the steel. We'll make it tough. And we did. But when I'd look at it, I just couldn't figure anybody in that business doing such a lousy job as they did. But then...
Well, and it's not like this is something they had done before. No one had used gliders for that kind of attack or for that kind of purpose before. I mean, that D-Day attack was revolutionary.
The truth is, anybody that's been there would tell you, even with sympathy, the gliders was a failure. No power, so even though we had them rigged up, they'd come in, coast into a landing, the pilot could get shot dead before he ever hit the ground and couldn't do a thing.
Yeah, really had very, very little control, and they were landing those behind enemy lines, not knowing what was awaiting them. Took a lot of courage to be on those gliders, either as the crew or the parachute infantry battalions going with them.
The most that the gliders had done, actually, they had used them there in Holland. But even then, they were having this wheel trouble every time they come back and landed. We got that squared away, but then the guys that was powering them lost their lives before they ever hit the ground. And so we went in and followed up on the ones that were still repairable. We'd check them all over. If we could get them to where they could hook onto them and take them out within 4 or 5 days, they would accept that as repairable. And so we set up a deal here with a cross rope. As I remember, it was an inch and an eighth nylon, and it was then tied onto this glider, and the pilot was sitting there like that, and then this old 47 would swoop down, and he had a hook that would made out of stainless steel. It looked like you could pull a freight car with it, and it would grab that rope. Well, that nylon rope had so much stretch to the inch, it was figured. Otherwise, it would have tore it loose from the glider or tore the rope in two, but it didn't. And the old boy get airborne, he'd turn around and wave to us.
And there were some times where you weren't sure those gliders were going to clear the trees on the end of the runway there?
That was on D-Day. And no, we just couldn't believe because we'd never put them to that test.
The D-Day invasion is starting, and you see C-47s tugging gliders from your base. And it came really close to being a real disaster there at the end of that runway.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I don't know, really, if the people that was in charge, if they were positive that 47 could take off loaded and then pull two loaded gliders. Of course, now once they got airborne and leveled off, you know, anybody that ever messed with aircraft, no problem. But until you got up, you were still, as the guy said, floorboarding, trying to get up to that level.
How close was it? What did you see?
There was a tree-lined fence line away down there that you could barely see until you put your glasses on. Field glasses, and we never thought anything about it. I mean, the average aircraft taking off, why, he cleared that. You could have had a plane going between them. But the guys that had glasses, we didn't all have glasses, said, oh my God, they're never going to make it over that tree line fence. Well, they just hit in the top of them trees, and they were just, it was like a strong wind on and off, on and off. Then it was like, yeah, I see what we done.
After the fact, after you heard what had happened on June 6th and the weeks that followed, found out how successful the overall operation was, albeit at great cost, was that some satisfaction on your part for having had a small role in that?
That would be tough to say. If you're saying mechanically, did the guys do a good job? Did it work out? Yes. But there was no way of putting a level of success, really, until it had time to reevaluate.
Yeah, so looking now, I mean, you know that was a day that changed the world, certainly changed that war.
Absolutely.
Does it give you some pride to think back and say, yeah, I had a little hand in that?
Well, it's true. It was a whole lot different than someone sitting in Texas. No, we just accepted the fact that they mailed back and radioed back that they made it, but they didn't try to say how many lost. But we had sense enough to know that there was aircraft shot down and didn't make it. And along with the ones that did, you had to accept the fact that so many wasn't going to make it.
Yeah, that had to be difficult. By the way, one of the photos you'll find in Jake's album on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page is General Paul L. Williams inspecting Jake's base at Cottesmore, England, and all the work going on there. General Williams was in charge of the 9th Troop Carrier Command. Gliders had previously been used in the invasion of Sicily, but General Williams oversaw the launch of more than 1,000 C-47s and over 900 powerless gliders on D-Day. They carried more than 13,000 paratroopers behind enemy lines. Think about all those men on all those planes and the incredibly dangerous duty they carried out. 6 months after D-Day, the Battle of the Bulge would be raging on a frozen European continent. And you weren't involved in that fighting, Jake, but I know you had to deal with some of the brutal weather, and you actually had to move from where you were stationed because of what was going on with the Bulge.
Well, we got run out because we weren't officially wasn't regarded as combat troops, although we had weapons and all that, but it was moving back. The GIs and the British were taking a hold and actually moving Germans back out of there, but it was a nasty thing.
Where were you at the time?
Well, I was in Brussels, and I had about 18, 20 men, and then another guy, a friend of mine, had the same thing. And I don't know, we just went by orders. You wait till the nth day of the month and be ready, and you're going to go over to the coast and then go back to England. In the meantime, we had our men set up in a hotel and just really doing nothing until that time. The war traveled in such a way you couldn't plan ahead except so far without having to take some time to replan what you're doing. I know this buddy of mine, we're sitting at a barber shop. I didn't understand German, but he did. And they come over the radio and said, we're sending in German troops in American uniforms, and they're going to kill all the teenagers. Well, that woman was cutting my hair, and I said, you know, I've never been shaved by somebody else. Just go ahead and give me a shave. Next thing I knew, that big old straight razor was going like that, and I said, no, hold it. I'll just pay you for what you've done. And I never did know how much of that they carried out or if they did, but it scared those poor people to death.
So you didn't find out later, until later, what had been said?
No, I found out more than I needed to know. Everybody else did. I'll never forget, we were, at one point, I'd been sent there to Brussels with three or four men to kind of evaluate what we were going to be up against a month from then. And it started storming. My God, it got up to about 2.5-3 feet of snow. And we just dug out by this big old rock, and we had didn't have a sleeping bag. We had a couple of blankets. We found out something, that if you dig down to the ground and then the snow is a foot over you, you get a certain amount of protection. Well, about that time, this old Canadian come along, and he kicked the snow off my head, and he said, Sarge, what in the hell are you guys doing down there? He says, you don't have to lay out here in this snow. And I just kind of kidding, and I said, well, I don't have an apartment rented. And he said, well, I do. I said, you guys go with me. We went down the street about a half a block, and they still had the old, well, like the old Springfield Ot-6. Pulled that up with the butt of that and bammed on that door about three times. Nothing happened. And he knew why. People were scared to death. Well, he given another rap, and I was surprised that he didn't beat the door down. But anyway, finally this woman come, and oh, she was good. He said, now just settle down. Sergeant here's got some boys out here, and they're sleeping in the snow. You're going to give them a bed. It wasn't like, can you? He says, you're going to give them a bed. Right. We went in, and we had a certain amount of food in our old duffel bag. And we told the woman, well, you're welcome to it. It's food that we don't care about. We just eat it day after day. Oh, it thrilled her to death. So she took us upstairs, and she had a young teenage boy that had learned English in school. And she couldn't speak a word of English, but he could. Well, here are these beds. I swear to God, you needed a ladder to get up on them. Oh, it's so beautiful. And you didn't have water plumbing. You had a thunder mug that scooted under the bed, you know. And anyway, we spent a couple of days, nights there that just wasn't bad.
Yeah, I bet it beat the heck out of sleeping in the snow. A little perspective goes a long way, huh? You were thrilled to have a bed, and she was thrilled to have some of your rations. So many things that we take for granted. And we're getting a glimpse into the real life of an American serviceman during World War II, one of those all-important behind-the-scenes jobs of repairing aircraft. And in order to do that, you had to manage to survive whatever might come your way. Were there ever times where you felt like your life was in danger?
Well, of course. I was on my way home, and I had one of the worst experiences that anybody could ever have. We were coming down, Rhone River, and we was on our way down the Mediterranean Sea, I guess it was, and they told us, we're going to stop down here, and you can take your men and just get out and go and know where to come back. So we wound up down there at the river and took off our clothes, just down to our GI shorts. We were going to go across the river. And I think it was four in my outfit that went with me. Well, it got a little deeper as we went, and I don't know. I just let it get deeper, and then our feet, we couldn't wade, and we started swimming. And the next thing I knew, we were floating. And I looked around, and these other guys had turned around and went back. An old dummy here that was supposed to be taking care of them, I was floating on nothing. And I looked all around, and I thought, man, what a dumb thing to do. Go through the whole war, and here we're on our way home. It's crazy. There was a period of time when I just shut my eyes and quit. It's a horrible thing. I just quit.
Wow. I don't know if any of us saw this story coming. So often we hear about those close calls involving bullets or artillery shells or planes or ships. And this one is after surviving the war in Europe, getting ready to come home to your wife and son, who you hadn't seen since he was 3 weeks old. We know you're here talking to us, so we know you made it through, and we're going to find out how after the break. The rest of Jake Luttrell's story on Hometown Heroes right after this.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and an engaging conversation today with a colorful character, Jake Luttrell of Bakersfield, California, celebrating his 92nd birthday this weekend with a couple grandchildren, 10 great-grandchildren, and 5 great-great-grandchildren. A whole lot of people who wouldn't be here if Jake didn't make it home from World War II and his duty using his welding skills to repair aircraft and improvise fixes like the rear landing gear on attack gliders. He spent time in England, France, Holland, Belgium, among others. And when we left off, he was remembering a close call after the end of hostilities when he was preparing to come home to his wife Doris and their son, who'd been just 3 weeks old when Jake shipped out. You told us that you went into the Rhone River with a few of your friends thinking you were going to cross it, but the current swept you away. You found yourself alone floating in the river, and it sounded like you were losing hope. You said you closed your eyes and just quit. Those were your words. You just quit. I guess there must have been somebody who didn't quit on you. How'd you escape that seemingly hopeless scenario?
I don't know how long or anything about it. I just remember that I more or less woke up, and I was over against a bank laying in mud and sand and water, and it was a little inlet in there where the water wasn't running. And I thought, well, how in the thunder did I get here, or what Well, I don't know. Someone was helping me. I know I was breathing so hard that I hurt my ribs. Yeah, it was hard. I tried swimming. I couldn't. So I crawled out of there. Here I had my dog tags and my GI shorts. And there was a guy laying over there on a blanket with some gals, and I tried to talk to them, but they couldn't get no word. So I just started walking down shoreline, little old town down there, and I could see the top of a bridge, and I think, oh, well, I got it made. I got down there, and the bank was up about 100 feet high, but there's a little old rock path down there to it, and here were two guys with old boats. Well, the reason I saw that thought it was a bridge, turned out that was the middle section, and it was still there from there over to the other side. But on my side, it was blown away. So I got down there to those guys, and I tried to explain to them by hand in a word or two. I need to get over there. I'll pay you. They jumped in that old flat-bottom boat, got them three oars in case they broke one, the way we went. And they got over to that midsection, and it was still no water moving. Well, they pulled up there against it and held on to it and rested, and then we started off. When we got far enough that I could holler at these guys and get a respond, I said, man, get your hand in your pockets, fill it full of money. I promised these guys they're going to get paid big, big money. Well, they were pulling it out, and these two old boys, I could see them yet. They just nearly went ape, and the guys started wading out before we even got to the dirt, and was handing them guys money, and they had some kind of an old sack around their neck that hung down, and they was cramming and filling that thing with money. Well, I didn't care if they give them $500,000. It was money we couldn't use as French money. All I knew was I was getting back to the other side.
Did you guys get in any trouble after that?
Matter of fact, he said, I'm not going to put your name in the paper, Jake, but he said, I'm just glad that you made it back.
Working in these air installations in Europe, were there ever times where you guys came under attack, where you were a target because of the work you were carrying out? What do you remember about that?
Well, you know, England actually was attacked much more than what the average person knew. A lot of it was bombing, but not with necessarily big bombs, which they did, but they had anti-personnel, 50-pound bombs. Well, they went out and took concrete blocks, you might say, about 3 feet long, and zigzagged them, and then another one that paralleled them, maybe like 10 or 12. Well, when they started coming over, they yelled, better get in. We'd grab a bite to eat and run out there and get down and crawl, and these bombs was hitting all over, but the only way they could get you, they had to hit you direct.
What does that feel like, though, to know that bombs are coming in and you're over here hunkered down behind some concrete hoping it doesn't land on you?
Well, I'll tell you the truth, man. It's hard to try to recall how you felt. You'd been scared so many times that it was just another experience from then that point to endure it until they waved the flag and we quit. I will never forget this one time in Holland. It was raining, and we dug holes and cut brush and so forth and piled over it because we didn't have tents or anything. That night was miserable. We were just laying in a hole of water. I'll never forget, I woke up that next morning and looked out there and that old American flag. Of course, no one had took it down, but it was just, the wind was blowing and sagging in that water pouring out. Nothing in the world, not even a 20-year-old blonde looked that good. That old flag was worth all the money in the world. And as it turned out, we felt like that's the way it was. Oh, I could go on for 3 days telling you about experiences and things similar to this. Like, I don't know if I ever told you about the little boy there in Holland. And I think I had talked to his dad or his grandpa, maybe it was 2 or 3 days before that. But he was working in the garden. He was about a quarter of a mile or so from where I was at. And I heard these explosions, but they weren't big, so that wasn't nothing. I went down that way, and I could see this youngster laying there. Well, he had picked up, well, it'd be about the equivalent of a hand grenade, big hand grenade. Just couldn't stand the thought of not playing with it or whatever. And he pulled a ring on that thing, and it blew him half in two, his insides. Well, I didn't know what to do really, but I picked him up and I carried him. And to this day, I don't know if it was his dad or his granddad. But anyway, he was very, very nice about it. I helped him get him into a shed there where he had a little bunk and bed. And he tried, you know, to express himself, but he couldn't. And I didn't say. But I mean, this kind of a thing, what are you going to do? It happens. Sometimes it's worse.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of things like that that you saw that you wish you could unsee. When you think back about it all now, the time that you spent in the service, and the fact that you were able to come home and see that little boy and then have another one, what are you most proud of in being a World War II veteran and all the things that you were involved in? What gives you a sense of pride now?
Well, just to be perfectly honest about it, I don't honestly think I could remember of giving myself credit for what happened or what we got done. It was more that we just had a job to do, and if we finished and got out of there, we were fortunate. Probably most all the guys had more serious thoughts about it maybe after they were home, maybe for 10 years, than they did at any point in time when they were just over there.
Was there a particular kind of airplane that you enjoyed working on?
Well, I was kind of a old B-17, and of course the old 47. It was like a Model A Ford. You couldn't keep it down. It was simple. It sure wasn't comfortable to ride in. We rode to Holland out of England, and on the way we were attacked by German planes, small ones. The co-pilot come back there, and he said, "Sarge, you can do whatever, but we're going to have to get down. We're going to have to get away from these guys. There's some parachutes laying over there, and they've been laying there 2 years. I said, "Well, I doubt if we would try them." I said, "Why don't you just drop the thing? It looked like pasture and all down there." Well, he did, but you could look. I remember you could look out them little old round holes, and they were, boom, them black smoke were saying to each other, "I hope the thunder he gets this thing down there." Well, he did, and it was an ex-German bomber base, so to speak, that had got blown out and round and done away with. For 3 days, we were on a diet of sardines. Yeah, but like I say, crazy things, that no matter where you is at. They come over one day, a guy that was given the risky job of being in charge of everybody. Well, it probably was a total of about 300 or 400 people. Said there's a guy down there in that barn, and every time anyone comes by there, he tries to blow them up. So there's about 10 of us went down there and circled that barn. We stayed out a pretty good distance. And he finally shot one guy in the foot. I said, "Well, we're either going to leave him to the buzzards or do away with him." So we waited till it got kind of halfway dark. And we got down there and crawled around till we got in this barn. And we had a flashlight. He had nothing. We located him, so we put him away and took him up to the guy that had given us the go-ahead. But it just seemed like it was an ongoing thing of that kind of stuff, especially when you changed and went to a new location.
What was it like to come home and see your wife and that little boy you hadn't seen in a while?
Probably the one greatest feeling that I ever had in my life. What was he? A general, Hap Arnold. He was our closest big name. He sent me a letter, and the wife and I sat there and read it and thought about it, and he said, if you'll re-enlist for 6 months, I believe it was, he'd reinstate me as a senior master sergeant, and I could have 8 or 9 location choices to serve. And I thought, oh boy, here we go. But no, I said, it wasn't great enough to leave the family, so I refused it.
Well, tell me about that moment when you saw your son again, because I'm thinking, if I were you, I'd be wondering, is this kid going to know who I am?
He didn't know who I was. Well, let's see, he would have been, 3 years old? Now, it wasn't long because he was an outgoing individual, redheaded, temper, but we made out great. It wasn't very long until he was well aware of who he was and who I was. But it was, of course, in a sense, harder for me to get used to than it was him.
I'm just imagining that was probably a pretty emotional moment for you? Because there were probably some times where you wondered if you'd ever see him again, right?
Oh, yes, no question about that. All of my family, all of them were still alive, including my mother and father. But then they didn't last all that long. And all of my brothers and sisters were still living. So I had a lot to come home to. There comes a time when you get my age now, am I going to be here tomorrow?
Well, but I know just here in recent memories, you had quite an adventure with Honor Flight Kern County. What was that like for you to go back to Washington and see that World War II memorial?
The only thing that could have made it any better, actually, if I'd have been, let's say, it's even 10 years younger, my man that was in charge with me, he's young and strong, and which it would have been great if I'd have been younger, because I'd have been able to physically do what I couldn't do.
What did you see there, though, that was meaningful to you?
Well, I had been there before and seen a certain amount of it, the wife and I had. I'm looking at pictures there today of when she and I had been there. But what we seen mostly was different.
Well, they didn't have the World War II memorial yet then. So when you got to that particular memorial with all the gold stars on the wall and everything else there, what did it mean to you? What did you think about while you were there?
You want me to really tell you?
Yeah.
Should have done it a long time ago. Now they're taking the boys to Vietnam. They shouldn't have had to have waited like they have. But at least now they are being recognized.
What did you get out of that? Of the whole experience, what did it do for you? What made it worth it for you?
First of all, it was just a joy, really. It wasn't like being there during the war when that was what you was there for, was helping create or discourage a war. You just had to really enjoy it and appreciate what had been done to make that possible. In fact, if I wasn't at my age, I'd look forward to going again. Now, I pushed on guys to go that wasn't going to go. But the fact that I had been there and back, I said, hey, believe me, first of all, you know I wouldn't lie to you, and I'm not overdoing it. I'm just telling you, make up your mind to go and relax. Take your medication. Take everything that will help you, you know, do better. And I say you will enjoy it. Well, every one of them did. Even Vernon Mirrors, that can't see and he can't hear. And, yeah. And he said, Jake, he said, that was wonderful. Well, again, his big 250-pound boy pushed him all over.
To be there, to meet all the people along the way, to come back home and have people waiting for you and cheering you on, did it make you feel like what you did meant something?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I think you could say it brought more meaning to it, because when we started back, it was like, well, the ball game's over and that's it. But when we seen all these people there and we knew we was going to sit down and eat together, and that just brought a new surge. Some of them wasn't real old. Some of them was 6 months, a year.
Sure, yeah. I mean, you think about your great-grandchildren and your great-great-grandchildren that you have. Is there something that you want those people and future generations of Americans to know about World War II and what all you guys did?
Yes, I don't know how it would work for them to experience the same feeling. I really don't. I hope they don't have to. On the other hand, they might have to do something worse. You know, at the end of World War I, that was said, that's it. Won't be anymore. As my dad said, part of his preacher philosophy, he said, where you've got people, you'll have trouble. I think it's always been. I could say if part of them was women, you'd have more trouble.
Now you're trying to cause some trouble. And there is one woman I need to thank, Lori Bird, Jake's granddaughter, for letting me know about him and making sure we recorded his story so the family would have it and so you could enjoy listening along today on Hometown Heroes. Happy birthday, Jake. And again, if you want to see the face behind that folksy voice you've heard for the last hour, hop on Facebook, punch in Hometown Heroes Radio, or just go to hometownheroesradio.com. Out of time for now. I hope you'll join us again next time when we hear from the captain of the 1941 University of North Dakota football team and hear about his PT boat adventures in the Pacific during World War II. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free.